9 months, and she got all the old data organized. And so she took all the OH data, in particular, all of the original working data and our notes and all that stuff, and just collected it, filed it away.
And this is at the Millstone Library, or
the Millstone Data Library.
Yeah. Let me just make sure. Okay, this is interviewing Lit Meeks in the AAS meeting in Amherst in August 71. Now, about this discovery, was there, first of all, was there a competition amongst different groups? I know that Barrett looked for it earlier at NRL and didn't find it.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about it, especially as Ed Lillian, I guess, had first mentioned it to me a year or so before. Before Sandy Weinreb came to work at Lincoln Laboratory, and so I'd say it was pretty widely known that among the group that was in Cambridge at the time that this was a good possibility, a good thing to look for. At the time, I think the detection came about really because Sandy Weinreb had just finished up his doctorate, and he had taken all his equipment down to NRAO to make the deuterium search. And the reason he took it down to NRAO is kind of interesting. He originally wanted, he and Jerry Wiesner, who was his thesis advisor, wanted to bring it out and run it at Millstone. But it turned out there was so much red tape involved in getting it on Millstone, it was easier to ship the whole thing down to Green Bay.
Dealing with the Air Force and all.
Yeah, and dealing with the Lincoln Lab. At the time, there was not an especially close relationship between the campus and Lincoln Laboratory. I don't think anyone had ever come out from the campus and worked at Millstone. So there wasn't any real precedent for it.
So this really was the beginning of that whole collaboration also.
Yeah, so Sandy had just got back from Green Bank, and he was, Alan Barrett took Sandy on sort of as a finishing graduate student to see that he passed his exams and so forth. And at that time, we proposed, I don't really remember the details of exactly how it came about, certainly it had been in Alan's mind for a long time, but the proposal was that Sandy bring his correlator out to Millstone, and we use a Millstone antenna to look for OH.
But had not Barrett looked for OH at NRL?
At NRL, yeah, and they hadn't found it.
And what was the main reason for that? Just the sensitivity?
Well, it's very strange. Even though they looked at the...
Look at Cass? And
they looked at the galactic center for absorption, and they should have seen it. It was the absorption in the galactic center was above their stated error limits. But they didn't see it, and Alan told me that he thought there was an equipment malfunction at that time, and probably that was responsible. But actually, their quoted limits, with their quoted limits, they should have seen it in the galactic.
This was published.
Yeah, this was published. It was given as a paper at the AAS, and I don't know whether it was otherwise published, but it's AAS. Well, in any case, I was very anxious to do the experiment for two reasons. Not only scientific interest in it, but at that time, I was attempting to get Haystack, which was then on the under construction. I was attempting to get as much radiometric equipment for Haystack as possible. And we didn't have an engineer assigned to it. And my thought was that if we could attract Sandy to come and work there after he'd finished his PhD, that he'd be a good person to get the thing started. So about the time we were thinking about this, the experiment came up, and Sandy decided to bring his correlator out and try it. So there were essentially three of us involved, Alan Barrett and Sandy Weinreb and myself. Sandy did
almost... What about Ed Lilly? No, you mentioned him before.
Well, Ed was not directly involved in this at all because he was at Harvard, and there was really no necessity for Ed to be involved.
Yeah. But he had talked about this.
He had talked about it. And I'm sure Ed probably knew that we were getting ready to look for it, although he didn't know the details. So Sandy brought his equipment out, and we paid him, something like half time, a quarter time, to get the car later rigged up and get it installed. Millstone and John Henry did the programming for the Millstone computer to present the spectra. And he did such a fine job that Sandy wanted to include John Henry as a co-author in all this. So actually, he invited John Henry before he cleared it with either of us. And I think it probably was an appropriate thing because even now, I don't think there's a better data presentation system than the one that we had running with the old CG24 computer at Millstone. We had instant display of the spectra, and we could average spectra, and we had all of those facilities going at the time. That was pretty much the background. Sandy worked. Sandy came in the early part of the. I guess he first came out in the winter of 63, and then he worked on this. Now, I can't quite remember the sequence of events, but I remember we were very eager to hire Sandy, and we were able to get a slot for him, the funds for him, and he just finished his PhD. I can't remember whether this was before the OH or after, but I think it must
have been. Why was the correlator such a key? I mean, why couldn't you use a filter bank?
Well, we could, in the light of hindsight, we could have used a filter bank, but Sandy's correlator had a proven ability to reach a very high level of sensitivity on the deuterium, and we felt probably it was a better instrument.
Which deuterium line was? Where was that?
This is about 327 megahertz.
Oh, the one that's comparable to the
one that the Russians thought they had discovered.
Right.
So it's a perfectly obvious thing. Sandy before, when he'd used his correlator at Greenbank, had just read the autocorrelation outputs by hand, written them down, and put them in the computer. And at Millstone, he tied the correlator into the computer so that the whole thing was automated.
No,
it was a very nice
system.
Yeah.
Did the line sort of appear the first time you got things working, or how did that work?
No, the first night we had everything running. We had detection on Cas A. I guess. Well, no, that's not strictly true. It was the first night. Sandy pretty much did all the hardware work. He had one technician working with him. He got everything going, and my responsibility was to check on the pointing and sort of.
You were most familiar with the antenna, I guess.
I was familiar with the system, but what we did first was to test the system out on the hydrogen line, and just see how well it, just see that we could get spectra and see that the system was working, the display was working, and that turned out to be really beautiful. We got beautiful lines. And good resolution, so forth. And all those data are in the file there. But the ability to see the hydrogen, of course, didn't mean that the system was working well enough to see OH. And there was a little bit of trouble that Sandy had to go to get the thing checked out. But essentially, I believe it was the first or second night that we tried that we found
Was this a conventional mixer-receiver? Was there anything unusual about the front end?
It used an uncooled paramp, which was furnished by some people at Lincoln Lab. So, we managed to borrow that.
So that was pretty advanced technology for that
time,
too.
Yeah, it was a pretty fair system. I would say, it was a nice system, and I always regret that we never bothered to look at any other sources. We looked at Taurus and we looked at Cass.
So you missed the emission.
So we missed the emission entirely, and with a correlator, you get by switching the sampling rate, you get the high resolution. I remember we got this detection in 1667, and then we tried 1665. I think that was the next night, and we got that. And then Sandy decided to take a higher resolution look. He was really interested in trying the correlator out, and I think he properly was the first listed author in the paper, because he really he did most of the work in getting the system going.
Yeah.
And Alan and I pretty much just waited around until the thing was going and helped out any way we could. After the first detection, we decided that this zero velocity absorption feature should be looked at a little more closely, just to try the system out. So he switched to higher resolution, I guess, increase the resolution by a factor of two. And then we went home, and the next day came back, and the fellow who had run the antenna, the data shows the spectrum with a double dip in it, which was, of course, this high-resolution picture of the OH. Well, that was pretty much the way things went, and we got tremendous cooperation from the people at Millstone. Gordon Pettengill was acting director, acting group leader at the time, and...
Well, how many days' observations were published? I guess it was in Nature, wasn't it?
The publications in Nature were all told no more than two or three days. Oh, two
so
or three nights.
Just immediately. Once you had the two lines, I guess there was no doubt about
that. That's
identification.
Right. We didn't try to look for the other lines. We just published these results.
Were you noticeably surprised over the abundance of the OH, or is that sort of most expected ones?
No, I'd say the whole result was kind of just about what we would have expected. Alan Barrett spent the summer, I guess, some part of the time in the summer, writing a little memo, a little account of the whole search, what he thought the results should be.
Beforehand.
And that memo is in the... in the file. That's a very good.
I still have a little difficulty understanding why it didn't happen before. Was it tried somewhere else besides NRL also?
It's very interesting.
The
story.
Technology was there, and the OH was talked about for many years before.
John Bolton. I talked to John Bolton about this, and he said that they had proposed several years before a search at Parkes, but that he said he had sort of turned it off, or he hadn't shown any enthusiasm toward it, because he expected that the OH would be just like the hydrogen, but just a lot weaker. He couldn't see any advantage, and he said, in just spending telescope time looking at something with a far lower signal.
I guess he wasn't too interested in interstellar chemistry or abundances or
anything
like that.
Yeah, I think John was not especially interested in the hydrogen line work either.
Yeah.
But then Charlie Towns was at MIT at the time, and he took a lot of interest in the results as soon as they were obtained. And I think one of the biggest things they accomplished was to really make radio astronomy a going operation at MIT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There had been no radio astronomy at MIT up until that time. I guess there had been a little bit at Lincoln Lab. Alan Barrett came to the campus about the same time I came to Lincoln Lab. And
what did Barrett come as?
He came as a radio faculty member. He came to build up the radio astronomy program.
Oh, I see. He did come as a radio astronomer.
Yeah,
then.
And he got funds to build a small, I think, a 12-foot millimeter antenna on the campus. But
the the Berkeley group was the one that discovered the emission, were they not?
No, that's a complicated story, and I don't know how that's been finally unscrambled.
It probably hasn't. Maybe that'll be my job.
Sam Goldstein first showed me the W49 profiles at 1665, 1667, and said there's at least 10 years' work for astronomers to try to understand this. And this was well before I'd ever heard of Berkeley looking.
Goldstein was at Harvard.
Yeah. And Ellen Gunderman was doing thesis, and I think this was sort of work done part of her thesis. But Sam Goldstein saw these lines, and then Ed Lilly had a heart attack, and he was in the hospital. So this work was never published. And then I believe that...
This is on the 60-foot at Harvard?
Yeah. That if Ed Lilly hadn't had the heart attack, that he would have pressed... Goldstein and Gunderman to publish this result,
but
he didn't, and Berkeley was doing the same thing, and I from my point of view, I think it was independent, and I think perhaps Harlan is a little bit ahead.
But they weren't confident enough in, Goldstein and Gunderman.
Well, they weren't. You know, they didn't have the desire to publish,
But he said it was 10 years' work for astronomy to understand it.
I think he was so puzzled by it, he didn't know what to put in the paper. I don't know.
Do you remember which sources these were? Or was this published right after, I guess, right, Berkeley came out, and then probably Harvard came out with its results?
Yeah, that's right.
Probably the same
A little bit later, but... and then Harvard claimed that they had seen it first. But the W49 is what I saw. And I had not seen a W3 spectrum until I saw the Berkeley preprint, the Mysterium.
Yeah.
About the only other thing that I could add at this point, the first time we looked at the... we just got the correlator going at Haystack. Literally, I mean, within a day or so, after it was running, we got this preprint, and we decided to look at the W3 emission. When we looked at W3 emission, we saw this characteristic peak of 1667, the central peak with the two peaks in a row, and it looked just like a modulated carrier. And it was so damn narrow, and it was completely different 1665, 1667. So we thought, what would be more logical
in
communication, just to pick something like 1665 that should be weaker and to send out a powerful modulated signal? And we talked about it, and in a matter of about a week or two, Alan Rogers had put some headphones on and said,
actually, listen.
But I'd say there was an exciting few hours or day there when we thought that we might be seeing a modulated carrier.
Now, were you thinking of extraterrestrial? Or?
Yeah, we were thinking of communication.
Really going on. What was he hoping to hear through the headphones? Was it just some sort of gibberish, I guess?
Well, I don't know. Alan got so excited about it that he wanted to try it. So.
Why was there no direct follow-up work after the initial MIT OH absorption? Discovery. It seems like you could have found the emission with a few more nights looking at different sources, or is that not true? These sources were not that obvious at this time. I mean, things like W49, and I guess.
Well, in looking back at it, I think we were all very excited about the result, and we would like to have observed more. But the problem was that this antenna was being used for radar astronomy and a lot of other purposes. And we really, after we got these first two papers out, we really didn't do any more because the energies of all of us had turned toward Haystack, and we really didn't follow it up. Alan Rogers was very eager to follow it up, and he used it a few nights, but then he went on to other things. We just weren't really set up like an observatory. to do that. And then the Australians, of course, began looking for the emission, which they never found. And in the process of looking for the emission, they found this very strong absorption. But I would say, looking back at it, that the discovery of OH at Millstone was an important milestone, because it really established MIT in the business of radioastronomy. We got the whole institute began to take the whole thing seriously, and a little bit later Bernie Burke came. But I'd say this was really it helped the haystack, it helped.
Well, in addition to, of course, getting... That was before the first recombination line, wasn't it? It was a couple years later.
Yeah.
But it also was the first molecule.
It was the first molecule.
It got microwave spectroscopy really going. And I guess I would have to say. Did Townes, you say, took an interest. He had been co-author with Sanders on the laboratory OH. Had he not?
Yeah.
And the same lines?
I guess he knew that the search was going on. He had, and he was interested in it. And when we had the press release, he was the one who sort of took charge of the press release.
But he never got involved scientifically.
He never got involved scientifically. He never got involved, interestingly enough, in any work at Haystack or any scientific work while he was at MIT.
He had
that opportunity, but
he had to go
to Berkeley.
Much at Berkeley now.
Yeah, right.
Or maybe he was interested in becoming president of MIT as a concentrating on administration or something.
That's possible.
Litt also told me that Sandy was essentially established his reputation on this project, and that led to him getting the job at NREO. And since that time, he's been very pivotal in all the line receivers and line work and so forth that's been done at NREO, so that not only was this the first radio astronomy at MIT and the first molecule in microwave lines, but it also really got NREO going in a big way, at least in line work. This is the end of the interview with Litt Meeks, August 1971 at the AAS meeting at Amherst, Mass.